The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Monday, the 8th of July, 2019. On the podcast today, Live Company Group Executive Chairman David Ciclatera and Andy Smith, Group Strategy Officer and Executive Chairman at Brightbricks, discuss their recent trading update. Also on the podcast, Neil Ricketts, Chief Executive Officer of Vesarion VRS, talks about the graphene order they've received from a Japanese global automotive components company. Also, Jeremy Martin, Chief Executive Officer of Horizonte Minerals, HZM ticker there, and Jeremy explains the significance of being awarded a power utilization permit for the Araguaia ferronickel project. Plus, Gil Holtzman, CEO of EcoAtlantic Oil & Gas, discussed their drilling operations, which have commenced offshore Guyana with the spudding of their first exploration well on its Jethro Lobe prospect. And as always, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is David Ciclatera, Executive Chairman, and Andy Smith, Group Strategy Officer and Executive Chairman of Brightbricks, both from Live Company Group, of course, LVCG. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Hello, good morning to you.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, now, you come on, you've got a trading update or trading statement last week, which it'll be nice to catch up on because there's a lot of information in there, and I know it was quite well received by shareholders and the like, so we'll dig into that and go through what's happening there. Before we do, as always, David, there are new people listening to the podcast all the time, so give us a brief summary as to what, you know, the Live Company Group is all about, please.
Live Company owns the BrickLive brand, and BrickLive is the a company that has exhibitions around the world based on bricks, and as you bought a company called Bright Bricks, so we're also the largest producer of brick-related models and things, and we have a global network. We're in every continent, and obviously we create tours, and our content is obviously something that is key to what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's dig into the trading statement. You've given an overview, David. Take us through some of the operational and financial highlights, if you could, of that.
Well, I think it's a half year, and we're 67% of our targeted revenue we've hit. We are pretty much ahead in our build program. We are basically looking to supersede our 15 tours that we're scheduled to build by the year end. So that's been going very well. And obviously, recently we've announced our relationship with international IP companies like Nickelodeon. So as the trading statement says, you know, we're ahead of where we expected to be.
When you say you've successfully secured 67% of your revenues for 2019 thus far, and that you said that's of targeted revenues, but I assume you can go beyond that. You can go beyond target, can't you?
So I'll take this one. I suppose the honest answer to that is yes. That's the aim. We have a kind of forward sales cycle, so we've secured a good chunk of the following year's revenue. So at any one time, we're booking tours or booking shows with kind of 12 weeks up to kind of 24 weeks sometimes lead time. So as with any company, yeah, the aspiration is to try and beat the target. But at the moment, we feel good about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's going very strong. In fact, Andy, you're here, so take us through, because I know when the deal came through with, Paw Patrol guys, Nickelodeon, it's a kind of big deal, like one of the most recognised brands in the world. So it's an important milestone for you. Take us through that, the significance of that, and what you're looking to do going forward as well.
Absolutely. The Paw Patrol in recent months, I'm told, has become the number one preschool brand in the world, as in televised show. So for us, it was a kind of landmark deal because Nickelodeon entrusted us with 10 of their shows. Obviously, Paw Patrol being probably the most well-known, but brands like SpongeBob SquarePants and Top Wing and Shimmer and Shine as well. So kind of any parents will know kind of just how important that is. And I think really that, if I put the kind of strategy hat on, I suppose spells the direction in which we want to go into. We've got to make sure we get this right because it's a big deal. And we've already launched the Paw Patrol tour and we've had an overwhelming number of inquiries to take the tour. We're following that up with the Nick Jr. tour in the next couple of months and then the SpongeBob SquarePants tour in January, all focused on the UK. But as I said, the aim has got to be to consolidate this and then look where we can kind of expand to from here. But yeah, no, it's you're right. It really is a big deal for us.
Yeah, well, I think
it's a platform for much more.
Absolutely, and I don't think people who are not aware of, not worked for a, I've worked for a brand, it's a radio station, very strong brand, and how protective, you know, they are over the brand, and they pour millions. I mean, you know, Paw Patrol is my kids' favourite now, SpongeBob, I actually watch SpongeBob with them, so I really love it, but they pour millions into these brands, don't they? So, you know, they are very protective of them, so to allow you to work with them in this way is an excellent status to be at, isn't it, really?
You're spot on. I'm a parent myself of a one-year-old and a five-year-old whose bedrooms are full of Paw Patrol and Shimmer and Shine. So in a previous life, I worked with Microsoft and Mojang, and it's a similar thing in that sense that, to your point, these brands are their focal points. So to be entrusted with the five-year agreement, I think is a huge sentiment or statement of confidence in both what we're doing as a product and hopefully us as... It's a flagship move for us, but actually in talking to the guys at Nickelodeon themselves, what we're doing isn't being done anywhere else. So it's as exciting for them as it is us, which is a really, really nice relationship to be in. Because as you said, I think if you go into any playground up and down the UK, you can't swing a cat for meeting a parent that doesn't know who the Paw Patrol are or SpongeBob SquarePants. So your assessment of it is absolutely on the money.
Yeah, yeah. And apart from this, you know, the IP and hooking up with brands and stuff, I mean, you are the strategy officer. Is there anything else you can tell us that you're looking at, you know, that's maybe a surprise maybe or maybe people expect it to, but, you know, the direction you're going in?
I think, as David said, we had a meeting with the shareholders last week.
Yeah.
And what I said to them, I think, is just as relevant now is... The UK really has become the flagship of how we operate the company. So we've moved into what I'd class as swim lanes, be it exhibitions, sets for sale, tours, which is what we class things as the Paw Patrol as. And actually really what we're trying to do is through the network David created is actually replicate the UK business model now.
Maybe you should explain, for example, the last weekend we've been meeting with our German partners and Germany is obviously a huge market, very big for these brands, very big for Lego, and just explain how we got on there, really.
Yeah, so that's really kind of one of the first conversations we've had about not just for our international partners viewing us as an exhibition brand, it's about them looking at us as, for clarity, the touring shows is different to the exhibitions, or also sets. Or even corporate builds. So what we've tried to do is take the business we have and transfer it through the network partners because it if we call it what it is, it enables us to scale quicker and there's a kind of consolidation of risk. So we're not trying to fight too many wars on all fronts, for want of a better phrase. It's using the network we've worked hard to build. And actually in the UK now, I feel like we've hit a real sweet spot. We'd committed to doing 60 events this year and we're already at 52. And I don't want to say that's all in the UK because it isn't, but a really healthy proportion is the UK. Been a really useful demonstration tool for the partners for understand just how scalable what we do is. So I think in terms of strategy, as you're asking, that really is the big focus now, is developing and enhancing the relationships with the partners to be something beyond just one or two exhibitions, but actually a 365 day a year partnership where you're driving lots of commercial activity with one another. That's really, for me, the kind of biggest takeaway I want anyone here in the company to really take from us.
And you say, for example, yesterday we talked about zoos. I mean, I was super surprised. There's 400 zoos in Germany, right? And as you know, that's some part of our zoos. And so, as Andy said, what we're able to do now is to sit with a partner and go, right, we do these things in the UK, they've seen them, and now let's roll out everything we're doing in the individual market. So over the next 2 or 3 months, we'll be meeting with our key partners, whether they be in Japan, that we've done Germany, other markets, and just get them to adopt what we've succeeded with in the UK.
To David's point, to kind of give a demonstration of that, we launched Bricosaurs at Marwell Zoo. Mm-hmm. And actually they hosted a lot of our clients. So we had 20, 25 visitors, and I would say 75% of them were from foreign shores, because there's now that interest zoo model, as we call it. So that's really the direction we're trying to move the business towards, still very much doing what we've always done, but it's almost like we now have product number 2, 3 and 4 now, rather than just a sole focus on the exhibition and license market.
Yeah, excellent stuff. And talking about, you mentioned, you know, meeting with shareholders, I know it means a lot to you. I mean, David, you are the biggest shareholder, but you decided not to accept an award of any bonus shares. Take us through why this has happened.
Well, you know, shareholder sentiment is that it's you have to listen. And I feel that the company, making the company successful, making the value of the company as large as it can be, is obviously important. I actually believe that it was just something I wanted to do. So basically, let's call it this way, it's my choice. That people can award me stuff, I don't have to take it. So basically, I decided to do that. And I think it's been quite well received, but that's not why I did it. I just wanted to basically get back to basics. We're a company that I think is a lot more valuable than people realize. I mean, one of the things that you would have read, because you're in this area, 10 days ago, there was this Merlin was basically bought by a combination of Lego and Blackstone.
Yeah.
And that's obviously huge, because what we are is a very sophisticated content provider based around bricks. And we also have a global distribution of shows. And I think that that is something that will be really of interest to us. And I think that the value of what we've built is not necessarily recognized in the P&L of the company. If you look at the asset base of the company, is now, you know, we basically bought Brightbricks, and we bought the assets, what we paid for the company. So frankly, yes, you're on the market, you have to worry about your P&L, but we're building, always building. And I think that the value of the company to the outside world, as I think it has been shown by how Merlin has been valued, as I actually believe that I'm very happy to be a 40% shareholder of this company. And that's all I can say at this time.
Yeah, and just that takeover there that, you know, being bought by Lego Merlin. So you thinking that's going to have obviously a positive effect on your company in some way?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. That's good.
I'll step in again. I think fundamentally, we'll always this as a positive. There's never a point where we wouldn't want to work more with either Merlin or Lego. So I think anything that drives the industry forward, and I think we've deliberately placed ourselves as, I suppose, the agile business, where we can pop up in many places, be it in the UK or globally, In a way that's probably different to how the market has experienced it before, be it through permanent locations or ticketed experiences. What we've tried to do is take our product to a marketplace that's demanding it in a way that is transportable but still credible. So I think it's really exciting. It's anyone could speculate what it means. The truth is none of us know, but the feeling inside the company is one of overwhelming positivity.
And I think one of the reasons is, if you think about, this is before the advent of working with brands like Nickelodeon's Paw Patrol, but the brands that we've created have meant that the traffic coming through the venues we've been in, we've got multiple descriptions now of how that's gone up by 30%. So we are able to provide content, not just for our own shows, but to third parties who basically can see visibly their traffic increasing. So, you know, everybody forgets this company is less than 2 years old on the public market, right? And we work so hard to build both this global network, which I think everybody to take for granted now. You're in China. Quite frankly, they have no idea how much effort has gone into building that network. But we've got the network. We now have the creativity and production capacities of Brightbricks. And we've also now, with the introduction of what I describe as globally renowned IP, we're in a fantastic position. And it's all about now growth and scalability. And that's why we have to get our shareholders in our way. They're not shareholders, but our partners, like our partners in Germany, to get them together and go, how big is this? And they have left absolutely pages of notes, pages of desire. And they, and you know, it's been a fantastic period for me the last 2 days, because they're just going to adopt everything we've done. And that obviously means more money, but it also means more value for the company and more growth of the brand. Everything is Brick Live. So every time we do stuff, everybody remembers and knows what Brick Live is about.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, David, well, listen, as always, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of what you're talking about, but are not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I think the first thing is that we have a global network. We're a global company. Secondly, we are a significant producer and content provider. We're a content company, and that, I think, is where the value of the company comes from. And thirdly, all the management have shares or options in the company. It's driven by the desire of the passion and of the management to build it. So they are my three comments for today.
Andy, David, really good to chat to you, and like I said, very busy, and no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Ricketts, CEO of Vasarion. VRS is ticker there. Neil, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin. I wish I was as excited as you on this day. It's you're always so excitable, but it's good to see you.
Well, I'm masking. I've got a cold. I don't know where the cold's come from. We have lovely weather. I've got a bit of a cold, but I'm masking that cold. But I mean, listen, you must be pleased. So you've got a Japanese graphene order. We'll discuss that in a bit. But as always, Neil, for someone who's never heard of Vasarion, just summarise the company if you could.
So we're an advanced materials company founded in 2011 by myself, and we take IP out of great UK universities like Cambridge and Manchester, and we turn that into commercial products that we as consumers can use on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, marvellous stuff. So Japanese graphene order, it's the first order from a North American corporate research and development centre of a Japanese headquartered company. So take us into this, Neil. Take us into a bit of detail here if you could.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of colour behind the scenes here. And this was, this has been taking us about 6 months to get from our government contacts at the DIT through Matt Walker. You know that Matt's currently seconded to us from that department. And, you know, these guys, they come with massive black books. You know, there's not a company in the world that we don't have access to as a result of these fantastic connections and contacts that we've been laying down for the last few years. I actually met Matt 2 years ago, almost to the day, out in South Korea, and we were on a trade mission covering South Korea and Japan. And a lot of the work that we're seeing now is a result of that work that went on 2 years ago when we started laying the foundations with the embassy and the DIT staff and all of those connections and contacts that you get as part of those trade missions. And here we are talking about, a development order. The guys have taken some material, they've tested it, they've analyzed it, they've worked out that it's right for what they want, and now they're starting to place bigger orders. And this is what we're starting to see at the moment, is there's a lot of skepticism about graphene, and people take small samples and they realize that what they're getting is what they wanted, and then they start placing bigger orders. Yeah. And that's great for the company.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, two issues here that, I mean, makes these cycles quite long, I suppose. That's the first, you're dealing with a big customer, big corporate customer, who, as we know, institutions that big never operate quickly. It takes a bit of time. Secondly, you're working with graphene, which is still relatively unknown in the commercial sense. So it's going to take a while, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, these things, it depends on the sector. It depends on the size of the company. It depends on the problem that you're trying to solve. You know, if it's a big problem for a company, they'll move very, very quickly. It doesn't matter what kind of size they are. But generally, the smaller companies work faster, and they're not as bogged down with the bureaucracy. And the bigger companies, you know, they take their time. They have big legal teams. They want to get the contract right. And the outcome is much bigger. So you can understand why they take their time.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what do you say? What's next? So they're placing this order, and then they'll do what with it? And are you hoping what will happen?
So generally what tends to happen is with a company, we'll have an inquiry and we'll do the NDA and all of that kind of, we'll supply them with a small quantity of material that they'll then characterize. They'll check that it is what we say it is and that it will do what we say it will do. And then what they do is they place bigger orders to try that material in their real applications. So it doesn't really matter if it's an oil and gas inquiry like we dealt with last week, or this one is more of an automotive application. You start to see how they're kind of using the material in their applications and their testing. And then what we tend to find is that the relationship develops because they can use it in more and more applications. And, it's great. The hopper's full. We're working through those. We're very focused. We've got a very significant priority. This isn't one of the five focus areas, and that's why it's more of an order rather than a collaboration at this stage. So this is all about us working with the customers and getting through these initial stages before we kind of sit down and become more formal.
Yeah, and listen, you've signed a lot of collaborations and letters of intent and MOUs and stuff, and so I assume you've still got quite a lot of that in the pipeline still to come, which is still being developed, have you?
Yeah, we're taking on more and more technologists, more and more technicians, more and more researchers in areas that we really, really need. We're putting Steve Hodge, our head of research, who's based down at Cambridge University, under a lot of pressure at the moment. The team itself is under a huge amount of pressure, whether it's commercial or whether it's technical or whether it's operational. You know, we've got to get these materials out to the customers. And so, you know, it's really great for the team, but it's quite challenging for the team as well. So we kind of, myself and Chris as the CFO, we have to balance, you know, what we want to do with what we have to do. And, the shareholders can be, confident that Chris is making the right decisions and that we're getting that balance right at the moment. So we have enough people in the business without necessarily having too many.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Okay. Give us the three reasons then, Neil. If someone's listening to this, like the sound of what you're doing, but are not yet following the story, three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay, so the first reason is that we are extremely well connected with our contacts at the University of Manchester, the University of Cambridge, the UK universities, central government through the Department of International Trade, and this particular inquiry had a big influence from that department. The second reason is that we're starting to make that transition from research and understanding how to operate these materials to actually getting to orders, and that's quite a significant change. And then the third thing is I'm the largest holder, so all of my aims and ambitions for the whole company are aligned with all of those stakeholders and long-term shareholders.
Yeah, well, excellent stuff. I mean, it's, you know, it's an impressive customer there. Sort of, you know. So, is it a household name, or are they behind the scenes? This company?
No, they generally. So, this is more of my background. So, kind of 30 years ago, I used to work for the tier one suppliers into the automotive industry, and this is one of those. So, people like Jaguar Land Rover, that they design cars, but they don't necessarily make all the parts that go into them, and it's these tier one suppliers that do most of that work now.
But that's big. So, operations, yeah. Operation in 40 countries, employing a quarter of a million people. That's a big outfit, isn't it?
Then this is a common theme. I mean, it's a bit like David and Goliath when, you know, you're 100 people and, you know, less than a third of the people are actively involved in graphene, dealing with companies that have, you know, 200 plus thousand employees, you know. It can be quite a challenge, but what we're doing is well received.
Yeah, yeah. What size order of graphene would make you panic?
We currently have capacity for 3 tons per annum, and okay. You know, we're scaling up. So it depends on your terminology. So scared or
Excited, but panicky. You know, so oh my word. It's almost like you know, you realise your numbers have come up on the lottery, but you can't find the ticket. Where's that ticket gone?
We got a team of guys who are actively working on the next level up. So we have the choice of either multiplying what we currently do, so having more cells of what we do currently, and that's kind of the easy option. But then we also have a team headed up by a guy called John Tatler that I've worked with for over 30 years, and he's looking at, you know, what if we have to produce hundreds of tons of this material, how can we do that? And he's working with our machine suppliers to work on those problems.
Yeah, cool. So it's a good problem to have. Marvellous stuff. Neil, thanks for that, fella, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Jeremy Martin, Chief Executive Officer of Horizonte Minerals. HZM's ticker there. Jeremy, thanks for joining me.
Justin, good to speak to you again.
Yeah, it seems like you're ticking off those boxes there and heading towards progress and, you know, final sort of action in the game zone there. But we've got Energy Decree. We'll get into that, what that means and why it's significant in a bit. But as always, Jeremy, if people listening right now are not familiar with the story here, just give them a brief summary. Horizonte, what's it all about, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're listed in London on the AIM and also in Canada on the TSX. We are a pure Brazilian-focused nickel company. We have two core assets, the Araguaia Ferronickel Project, which is a discovery we made, then acquired assets from Glencore, Teck, consolidated it and took that through a feasibility study. And we're aiming to start construction at Araguaia next year. And then we also acquired our second potential mine from Vale, which is the Vermelho Nickel Cobalt Project. Key thing about this asset, it's within trucking distance of Araguaia, and it is one of the largest, highest-grade nickel-cobalt resources globally. So we have a very large nickel resource base in a region with infrastructure and poised to come online around a pretty compelling nickel market. So that's a summary on the company.
Yeah, and if someone's listening to this now and say, okay, what's the deal with nickel? What do we need for it? What's the market, and how's it stacking up at the moment? What would you say?
Yeah, I think out of all the commodities, the fundamentals behind nickel are compelling. Today, we produce around 2.2 million tons of nickel. The main use today is for stainless steel, so around 70% of that is consumed by the stainless market, which is growing at around 4 to 5% a year. So stainless would be used in everyday items from knives and forks through to corrosive piping in power stations. It's a key fundamental material for economic development. That market's robust. And then what we've had come into the market in the last sort of 3 or 4 years is the electric vehicle battery market, where we're seeing nickel as a key chemical in the battery chemistry. So going forwards, we're trading at sort of around $12,000 a ton nickel today. Short to midterm consensus pricing is around $16,200. So you've got all the key things that you want in a commodity. You've got inventories being drawn down. We're actually at the lowest levels on the LME that we've seen for the last 6 years. We're around 160,000 tons, robust demand, and very few projects to come online in the next sort of 2 to 3 years. And Araguaia is one of those key projects that's ready to go.
Okay, all right. And so take us through this this bit of news here. It's an energy decree. What does this mean?
Yeah, so it's another key piece of permitting which we've successfully achieved. This basically is the energy and the energy department in Brazil guaranteeing us access to the national grid and also guaranteeing us the required power on an annual basis for the Ferronickel operation. So it's all about building out all of these milestones, ensuring that we're getting our permits, and also ensuring that and showing that the project is moving forwards to the construction phase. And we're achieving these permits on a very regular basis. And it's also showing that Brazil is really open for business in terms of allowing projects like this to be taken forwards to construction.
Marvellous stuff. And that energy there, you got how much you got? 80 megawatts up to, is that enough for what you would need? How much is that?
That's our sort of average annual requirement. The key thing in Brazil, it's in this part of Brazil, in the Pará state, it's hydroelectric power. So it's low cost power. We will be a large consumer of power. So yes, there is capacity. It's at the right power costing. And that's why it allows Araguaia to be one of the lowest cost operations globally, because you've got the low-cost power, you've got the infrastructure, and also the project is very high-grade. So all the things that you're looking at, you want to be one of the lowest-cost producers coming online, and we feel we're able to achieve that.
Yeah. Well, let's be honest, you can't start your production there without power. So it's an essential part of the jigsaw coming together. So what's next? What's the next sort of milestone you're hoping to tick off then, Jeremy?
Yeah, so on Araguaia, we're working on the project financing. We're working with Endeavour Financial. We've got a consortium of seven banks working on the debt piece for the project finance. We're also actively looking at offtake agreements, and we're getting strong interest there. And the aim is that as we move to the end of this year into early next year, we're financed to start the construction of the project. We're obviously in parallel with that, looking at the team, the project director, and she is a key appointee as we move really from being an exploration company into a producing nickel company. So that's all ongoing. So in terms of news for the second half of the year, there'll be updates on the financing, updates on permitting, updates as we start to obviously talk with equipment manufacturers, etc. And then on our other project, the Vermelho Nickel Cobalt project, we've got a pre-feasibility study underway on that. We aim to release that to the market shortly. That's looking very exciting. That's obviously the project that we acquired from Vale. That's going to show a very high grade profile for the life of mine. And we're fairly confident the economics on that will be pretty exciting. So it's a very busy period for us.
Yeah. What's your I know you can't do anything about the share price there, but what's your take there? You released a key bit of economic news in your feasibility study a while back in October. The share price has fallen and it's sort of bumping along the bottom here. What's your thoughts on that? I mean, you must have thoughts on it, mustn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a major area that we want to work on. I think there's a couple of factors here. If you look at the market in Q4 last year, the whole junior mining sector effectively took a significant step down in terms of value. I mean, you look at anything from mid-year last year, they were all sold down. That really ran in parallel and continues with the macro issues that we have, obviously, with the US-China tariff issue, which is a big overhang in the marketplace. And I think you've just seen a number of issues, not only that issue with the US-China, but at home we've obviously had the Brexit situation. There just seems to be a feeling at the moment that the markets, it's a risk-off environment. People are they want to see where the world is going, and obviously we are sitting in that higher risk category in terms of investment. So I think that's one area why we've seen share prices on not only us but most of our AIM peer group have been sold down to lower levels. But I think going forwards, it's an exciting time. I think we're going to see definitely nickel price moving in the right direction as we move into next year. We're obviously in a strong position. We're funded. We've got a very good group of shareholders for the likes of Teck, Glencore, JP Morgan. And the world needs nickel. And we have two of the best nickel projects in the world. So I think over the next 12 to 24 months, we should see a significant reversal in our valuation and a re-rating.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Okay, as always, Jeremy, then, in summary, three reasons, if someone's listening to this why they're not following the story, why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, absolutely. We've talked about some of these, but just to put them in a sort of condensed format, number one, nickel. The fundamentals behind the metal are compelling. If you as an investor want to get exposure to nickel, whether it's for the traditional stainless market, we can do that via Araguaia, or whether it's for the new growth electric vehicle battery market via Vermelio. So we have two of the highest grade, largest nickel resources globally. These really are tier one assets. So that's point number one. Point number two is the company has a very strong shareholder base in terms of those names I've talked about. And really there are very few quality opportunities like this to get exposure to nickel. And opportunity number three, there's going to be some major milestones out over the next 12 months as we move forwards to construction with Araguaia. So, it's an exciting time for us, and we look forward to keeping everybody updated.
Excellent stuff, Jeremy. Good to chat to you. And like you say, lots going on. So no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Many thanks.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Gil Holzman, Chief Executive Officer and President of Eco Atlantic Oil and Gas. ECO is ticker there. Gil, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Justin. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Well, listen, it must be quite exciting for you at the moment because right now, as we speak, and it started, I think, last Thursday, operations drilling is commencing there. Before we get into the detail here on this high-impact prospect, just for people not aware, Gil, summarise Eco Atlantic Oil and Gas, please.
Eco Atlantic is an oil and gas exploration company listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange and in London Stock Exchange. We are focusing on exploration in highly prospective but somewhat underexplored regions across the Atlantic margin. We have four offshore blocks we operate in Namibia, and we have one offshore block that Talo operates with us for us. Offshore Guyana, adjacent to the 5.5 billion barrels discovery made by Exxon Mobil and partners on the Stabroek block. And as you rightly mentioned, we started drilling operations 4 or 5 days ago.
Yeah. Okay. So first and foremost, how long will this take then before results are out, do you think, Gil?
We announced that we will probably be in a position to publish the results in 40 days after SPUD. As I said, we SPUDed last Thursday night, Guyana local time. So that was the 4th of July. So I expect to have results by middle of August, assuming operations will go as smoothly as we anticipate. Talo has a very experienced team operating this well on board of the Stena 4th drill ship. And as I said, I see a lot of momentum building into the story and building into the name towards beginning in mid-August.
Yeah, absolutely. And ideally, Gil, what would be the perfect result for you here?
Naturally, for an oil and gas company, oil and gas operations, the perfect result is a discovery. Oil discovery at a good built reservoir with good flow rates. We are drilling this first well, this Jethro Lobe, and we're casing it and logging it as we go down. So I think we will have a very good understanding on all the characteristics of this hopefully discovery once we are able to announce the results. If we have a discovery, then we have many, many options still to be discussed with the operator Talo and our partner on the block Total, whether we appraise it, whether we start production drilling, whether we go ahead and drill all the many other prospects that we have, but we're still not there. We will know in mid-August, and then we'll take the decisions. But naturally for us, for shareholders and for the JV, the perfect results will be a discovery.
Yeah, and just remind people on this particular prospect, what the resources are, what's the size of the resource here?
According to the CPR that we published and is available on our website, it's a public domain, we anticipate around 220 million barrels at best case, best estimate. It can be less, it can be more. However, from much we understand the structure of this play, it has the potential to open additional series of oil pockets, put it this way, surrounding this Jeffer lobe. But again, we will know much, much better in the next 30, 35 days once we TD.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay. And like you say, this is possibly one, what, of six? Is that right, you're funded for?
No, we are funded for, on top of these two, which are already committed and announced, and we started the first one, we're going to immediately, after drilling Jethro Lobe, we're going to immediately spot the next prospect, which is Joe, on the same block. However, on top of that, at current rates, we are funded for at least additional six exploration wells for next year. As I said, we have identified between the partners, Talo, Total, with their very experienced exploration teams, we have identified more than 15 prospects in various plays. Some are tertiary, some are Cretaceous. So there's a lot of work to be done on this block, regardless what will be the results of these first two wells. There's a lot of work to be done, but naturally we hope for a big discovery. I think, as I said, that you will see a momentum built around Eco Atlantic in the next couple of weeks. All those people, we appreciated around 200% in our share price in the past year and a half, and many people before we spotted decided to take some profit, which is very normal. However, at current share price, at current levels, I think there's a very good opportunity for new investors and new institutionals to come in and anticipate for positive results. And I think you will see a lot of momentum built around our company. Although it's the middle of the summer, this is one of the wells that the entire industry and the investors alike are looking at. And I think there's a lot of activity that we will see in the next 2 months around our name and around the offshore Guyana drilling.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Okay, as always, Gil, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what's happening here but are not yet following the story, in summary, three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page, please.
The first reason is Jethro Lobe. We will know if we have a discovery middle of August. The second reason is Joe Prospect. We will drill it beginning of middle of August, and we'll have the results beginning of September. And the third reason is the additional 12 or 13 targets that we have on the Orindwig block offshore Guyana, as well as the four offshore blocks that we have in Namibia. Namibia is picking up again, and you will see a lot of exploration activity and a lot of corporate activity around Namibia in the next couple of months. We are very well positioned there. So Guyana drilling campaign, Namibia, four offshore blocks. You will see a lot of activity around Eco Atlantic in the next few months.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Gil, good to chat to you. Like you say, lots going on. So no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Justin. Have a nice day.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Europa Oil & Gas, that's EOG, up 26% to 3.6 pence at the moment. At four, EVR Holdings, up 6% to 8.75 pence. At three, it's Agronomics, ANIC, up 44% on Friday, but down 15.3% today. It's got a volatile stock there. I did cover that chart yesterday on my videos on YouTube. I like the thematic version, you know, space that's in. It's in clean meat, lab meat. At two, SafeStay, SSTY is ticker there, up 1.33% to 38 pence. I also covered that in the podcast yesterday. Not podcast, on the videos. Just on my YouTube channel. Just search Justin Waite YouTube. It should come up. And also, I covered Open Orphan, which is the number one most followed company. ORPH is the ticker there. And up 8.96% to 7.3 pence. Okay, it's time for the top five most liked RNSs. At five, Nostra Terra, operations update and correction. At 4, SDX Energy, operational update and corporate update as well there. At 4, at 3 yesterday, Integumin. I do apologise, I'm a bit bunged up. I can't concentrate properly, I can't even count, obviously, but it's man coal, which is, of course, about 50, 60 times more powerful than normal coals. Integumin, AGM notice and trading update. Add to Viserion, Japanese graphene order, of course, Neil was on the podcast. And also, number one, power utilization permit awarded for Araguaia, and I spoke to Jeremy Martin about that. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.